Texas Fish and Game Magazine, September-October 2025 issue, audio edition. In this issue, surf basics for big reds and specs, tips from the Fish and Game Saltwater Playbook, compiled by Texas Fish and Game staff. Dodging a bullet on public land loss. A recent effort to sell millions of federal acres failed. For now, feature story by Chester Moore. Public dove and ducks finding hidden wing shooting spots away from the crowds on public land. Feature story by Matt Williams. The scariest animals in Texas. The Texas outdoors has tusks, venom, and other dangers. Feature article by Chester Moore. Top-notch hunting coverage. Marullo and Wysoon, Fish and Game's hunting specialists. The Fish and Game Profile Series. Compound or crossbow. Which weapon best suits your hunting situation? Feature article by Dustin Vaughn Warnke. Cast and Blast. A look at the wealth of hook and bullet options waiting for Texas hunters and anglers. Fish and Game Special Section. Plus, columns, outdoor news in the Fish and Game Report, coastal focus reports by professional saltwater guides, and more. So listen, learn, and enjoy. Our Lakes and Bays Atlas is now interactive. Inside Fish and Game by Roy and Ardia Neves. One of the better ideas we squeezed out of our heads during the past 41 years in the outdoor publishing business was the annual Texas Lakes and Bays Fishing Atlas. TLNB was originally designed as a subscription premium back in the late 1980s, when Texas Fish and Game was on a wild and crazy circulation building spree. We printed the first few editions on dingy newsprint, spewed still ink wet from the same old printing press in Marble Falls where Fish and Game first came to life. From the very beginning, production values aside, Lakes and Bays was an ambitious project. With it, we sought to profile every bay system on the Texas coast and as many freshwater impoundments as we could fit into a 104-page press run. Each of the 45 locations in the first edition included a map, drafted by hand by Nancy Spivey, wife of founding editor Marvin Spivey. Marvin wrote profiles of each water body, including map-keyed descriptions of best fishing spots, ramps, and facilities. TLNB was an instant hit, and as a promotional item, was instrumental in Texas Fish and Game's meteoric rise from near zero to 100,000 readers between 1986 and 1991. We've published Lakes and Bays every year since, and with each succeeding edition, we added a bit more ambition. In the early 90s, we put it out on Texas newsstands, and it immediately took the crown of best-selling outdoor title, at a time when newsstands still occupied high-profile positions in every retail establishment and periodical publications flourished. Along the way, we continued to refine and improve. We more than doubled the page count and enlarged the pages to better display ever-increasingly detailed maps. In 2003, as marine electronics began to revolutionize fresh and saltwater fishing, we overhauled Lakes and Bays to include hundreds of specific fishing hotspots, provided by partnerships with fishing guides who worked each of the profiled water bodies. A few years ago, we partnered with Navionics, allowing us to enhance the map detail and provide depth contours to each of the published maps. Texas Lakes and Bays Fishing Atlas remains one of our most popular products, selling briskly at Academy Sports Outdoors and other retail locations around the state and through our online store. But the world of physical print publishing is nothing like it was in Texas Lakes and Bays' infancy. In those days, not even the most avid Star Trek fan could have envisioned high-res screens, not much bigger than a deck of cards, putting more information in our hands instantly than every magazine on every newsstand from Texarkana to El Paso, Port Arthur to Port Isabel could possibly deliver. Still, we keep manufacturing TLNB every year, and we still work hard to continue making it better. This year, we cracked the code, so to speak, for blending our printed Lakes and Bays edition with the world of digital interactivity. In past editions, we devoted dozens of pages to tide and salooner forecasts. As a printed product, this had immediate limitations. Space limited the number of locations that could be forecast, and time froze the instant those forecasts were pressed in ink onto the pages. This edition, out and available as you read this column, has a new interactive feature. QR codes, printed on every map, allow you to get up-to-date tide, solunar, and weather conditions for all of the profiled water bodies. For the lakes, the QR code links provide current water levels. The beauty of this interactive feature is that we can continue to tweak and improve the information, adding new and updated features. Look for the new edition of Texas Lakes and Bays at Academy Sports Plus Outdoors or wherever you can find a newsstand. Or you can order it direct from our online store at fishgame.com/fishgamegear. Email ardia@aneves@fishgame.com. Email roy@rneves@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. AI in the Outdoors. Editor's Notes by Chester Moore, Texas Fish and Game Editor-in-Chief. Artificial intelligence, AI, is changing the world, including the outdoors. For anglers, hunters, wildlife photographers, and outdoor media professionals, AI is proving to be a powerful tool. But like any tool, it depends on how it's used. And right now, it's creating one of the most complex challenges we've ever faced in documenting and celebrating outdoor traditions, telling what's real and what's not. It's one thing to stretch the truth about the one that got away. It's something else entirely to fabricate an entire fishing trip with lifelike photos, GPS coordinates, and a detailed narrative, all generated by an AI model. In 2024, a Florida man claimed to have landed a 700-pound marlin off the coast of Key West. The image he posted on social media was striking. Ocean mist, sun glare, the proud pose, the glistening scales of a monster catch. But closer inspection revealed inconsistencies in the fish's proportions, and it was eventually exposed as an AI-generated image. Here in Texas, a now-viral photo of a supposed record-breaking alligator gar is making the rounds. Many who saw it believed it was real. Even some seasoned anglers were initially convinced. But as more eyes analyzed the image, telltale signs of AI manipulation surfaced. Lighting that didn't match the angle of the sun, oddly uniform scales, and a pose that looked too perfect. And it's not just limited to fish. Similar trends are starting to show up in the hunting world. Images of monster bucks, boars, and turkeys that look convincing enough to fool many, if not most, viewers at first glance. Some of these images are used to drum up social media followers. Others are even used to market fake outfitters and hunting trips, banking on the believability of AI-generated proof. AI isn't inherently bad. It's already being used for good across the wildlife and conservation world. Machine learning algorithms are helping identify animal species on trail cams, monitor poaching activity, and even model fish populations more efficiently. That kind of progress is exciting, and it's helping biologists and resource managers work smarter than ever before. The issue is not with AI itself, but with how easily it can now be used to fabricate content that looks entirely real. As a publication that has long prided itself on telling real stories from real people in real places, this puts us in a complicated position. Even for seasoned editors and photographers, some of these images are becoming incredibly difficult to verify with the naked eye. A photo that looks plausible might contain subtle, almost invisible signs that only metadata or AI forensic software can catch. And not every story has a data trail to follow. This isn't just frustrating, it can be dangerous. In a time when conservation decisions depend on accurate public understanding and when hunters and anglers are fighting for their rights and their image in the broader culture, misinformation, whether intentional or accidental, does real harm. This is why outdoorsmen and women need to stand behind vetted, professional media outlets like Texas Fish and Game. We're not immune to these challenges. We have to ask the same tough questions everyone else does when reviewing reader submissions, field reports, and wildlife photos. Is this authentic? Was this verified? Are there signs of AI manipulation? But we also have a team of experts, seasoned hunters, biologists, photographers, and journalists who have decades of hands-on experience. We know how light behaves in a photo taken at dusk in South Texas. We know what an honest 12-point buck looks like and what tracks it leaves behind. We can call up game wardens, outfitters, and landowners to get confirmation when something seems off. And that editorial vetting is more valuable now than ever. We don't always get it right immediately. The tools being used to generate AI content are evolving fast. but we are committed to transparency, ethics, and truth. That's a promise you don't get from random social media posts or unverified viral content. So what can you, as a hunter, angler, or outdoor enthusiast, do in this new landscape? Be skeptical, but not cynical. Amazing catches and hunts do happen. Just approach wild claims with the same critical thinking you'd use for a sketchy trail report. Ask questions. Where was this taken? Who was there? Can you verify it? Most real outdoorsmen are proud to share the details. Support real reporting. Subscribing to publications like Texas Fish and Game helps us continue to do the hard work of vetting stories, verifying facts, and holding up a mirror to the actual outdoor experience. And above all, celebrate the real. Whether it's a 3-pound bass caught with your kid or a challenging hike into elk country that didn't result in a tag, there's power in authenticity. Don't let algorithms rob us of the value of real, lived moments. The deeper risk of unchecked AI content isn't just that we get fooled by a few pictures, it's that we begin to doubt everything, even the truth. When enough fakes circulate, they begin to drown out the real stories. People start to assume everything is fake. And when that happens, even legitimate accomplishments, record-breaking catches, and decisive conservation wins get called into question. We can't let that happen. AI is here to stay, and it's going to be part of our lives outdoors and in for the foreseeable future. But so is integrity. So is curiosity. So is craftsmanship. And so is truth. As always, at Texas Fish and Game, we'll keep working to bring you stories from the field that are just that, from the actual field. Because no matter how smart the machines get, they still haven't learned how to sit in a blind at 5 a.m., swat mosquitoes, whisper to your buddy, and feel that thrill when the brush finally moves. Some things, thankfully, are still better left real. Email Chester Moore at cmoore@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. Plugging with the Master. Doggett at Large by Joe Doggett, Texas Fish and Game Senior Contributing Editor. Rudy Grigar, the self-proclaimed plugger, was an original and true to his light tackle game. He used long, whippy two-handed rods and level wind reels and chunked lures for speckled trout and redfish, period. Live bait or fresh dead was never allowed, and almost exclusively, he waded, usually in the bays, occasionally in the summer surf. His boats, big center consoles, were just conveyances to run long fetches of open water to reach prime wading shorelines. I fished with Grigar off and on for at least 20 years, from Galveston and Port O'Connor to Louisiana's Chandler Islands, and never saw him deviate from that classic school of Gulf Coast plugging. Our first session was most memorable. I joined the Houston Chronicle newspaper as a full-time outdoor writer in the summer of 1972, and the following spring, Houston-based Grigar invited me on an overnight trip for speckled trout in lower West Galveston Bay. I was thrilled. I had previously caught specks while free shrimping with live shrimp at the Galveston jetties and under popping corks in the bays, even a few on spoons and plugs in the green surf, but never in the company of a pro-class plugger. Grigar had a small, weathered bay house on Mudcut on the south side of sprawling San Luis Pass. That night we feasted on blue crabs he caught from a pair of chicken wire traps on the sagging wooden dock. I awoke at dawn, on fire with the trout fever. Muggy wind was light from the southeast, and scattered clouds bloomed across the open gulf, ideal conditions. I was dismayed to find him futzing around, in no hurry to go anywhere. "Relax," Grigar said. "We need to let the incoming tide get going." We pushed his Boston Whaler from the dock an hour later and ran about 15 minutes across the big pass to a nondescript open water spot on the Galveston side of the main channel. The bow nudged onto the edge of a knee-deep sandbar, and he told me to drop the anchor. "Not loud, don't chunk it, just slip the chain." Grigar presented me with one of his hand-tweaked plugs. It was a venerable 52M series Miro lure, but the metal line tie eye had been removed from the top of the head and screwed straight into the nose to track shallow. Several years later, the Landes Bait Company in Florida finally listened to the Texas pluggers and introduced the nose-rigged 51 series, still popular today. The plug had a white back and a white belly with silver Miro sides. But Grigar had spray-painted the entire back with bright chartreuse, Pink was the new hot color back then, and few anglers had seen chartreuse patterns. I can't say he coined the concept. Maybe he picked it up from another plugger, but it was the first one I saw. We rolled from the boat and waded on hard sand across the shallow bar. The green to the beach, incoming tide was flowing richly across the flat, bringing nervous pods of riffling finger mullet. Gregar pointed with his rod tip. Watch for those mullet and put your casts just ahead. Fast retrieve, keep it moving, and remember to shuffle. Stingrays. Minutes later, I turned to an abrupt splash and saw my partner standing under a bent 7-foot rod, hooked up on a fine speckled trout. A wad of the small mullet drifted past 50 or 60 feet away, and I flicked a soft sidearm cast across the breeze. The mirror lure plopped down, and the close mullet flurried from the commotion. Several jive-talking reel cranks later, a long silver and spotted flash rushed broadside to intercept. The line came tight, and I was fast to a gorgeous 4-pound trout. That was the first time I saw a game fish strike a lure in shallow water. I still remember the thrilling image in vivid detail. Several times, once the sun got higher, predatory trout were visible ghosting across the white sand. Gregar and I fished for about 2 hours, until the tide played out and the baitfish parade stopped. The flat was now thigh deep. He strung a dozen or so specks, and I had about half that number. All were solid fish, and all were taken on the mullet imitation plugs in shallow water. I had previously enjoyed days of more fish on live bait from boats, but nothing equaled the one-on-one experience of stalking with lures. It was a lesson in quality versus quantity. More than that, it showed that wading shallow with light tackle can make even average fish exceptional. There is absolutely nothing wrong with slinging a free shrimp or working a popping cork, but I was awed by the purest game that the pluggers played on the Texas tides. I knew I wanted to join the salty ranks. Shallow running scooters were being built for a select few in South Texas, but that first session predated the armada of tricked-out Florida bonefish skiffs and poling platforms along the Gulf Coast. And in the early 70s, nobody knew what a graphite rod blank or a soft plastic tail was. Both started showing in big numbers 2 or 3 years later. Fly fishing was virtually absent on the bay complexes north of the Laguna Madre, and many of today's standard-issue accessories and accoutrements for bay fishing did not exist. The original pluggers in faded khakis and canvas sneakers, chunked hard plugs and spoons with long fiberglass rods, and Ambassador red reels, and made it work with a simple but elegant stance, the genesis of the game we play today. And as a rookie, I was fortunate to wade through a sparkling green tide in the wake of a master. Email Joe Doggett at contactus@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. Surf basics for landing big reds and specks. The Fishing Game Saltwater Playbook. Feature article by Texas Fishing Game staff. Late summer and early fall on the Texas coast is a magical time. As the summer heat begins to retreat and the Gulf's surf cools just slightly, it sparks a surge of life along the beachfront. Mullet run in the troughs, shrimp skip across the surface, and the redfish and speckled trout come in close to feed. For anglers willing to beat the sunrise and keep things simple, it can be some of the best fishing of the year. There's a certain rhythm to fishing the surf in September and October. It's not fast-paced in the traditional sense, but it's electric. The early mornings start with a soft orange glow over the water, waves rolling gently into the first gut, and a whisper of wind from the north. That's when the big reds start showing. One of the most consistent patterns for bull reds in early fall is around the jetties and major passes. These fish are staging to spawn, and they gravitate to areas where the current moves bait around the structure. First light is the best time to be there, especially during a rising or high tide. You don't need anything fancy, just a stout surf rod, a circle hook, and some live bait. Mullet or blue crab does the trick. Cast right where the sand and rock meet, beyond the first breakers, and let the bait do its thing. Don't rush it. These reds will often mouth a bait before making that big telltale run. That's your cue. There's a tendency, especially among newer anglers, to move their bait or check it constantly. But in early fall, patience pays off. Let your live bait work naturally. A croaker flipping in the surf or a crab kicking in the current puts out all the cues a redfish needs to strike. Set up with minimal weight and let the surf move things around. The fewer artificial touches you add, the better your odds of connecting with a big red. As the sun climbs and the reds move out deeper, another surf star takes the stage, speckled trout. And the first sign that they're feeding? Slicks. If you see glassy patches forming between breaking waves and smell that faint watermelon scent in the air, you've found an active trout zone. Slicks are the result of trout feeding below and releasing oils into the water. They tend to pop up in predictable troughs early in the day, especially when small ribbonfish or glass minnows are around. Spotting slicks isn't enough. You've got to know how to fish them. A good approach is to cast metal spoons or soft eel imitations just down current from the slick edge and retrieve with a twitching motion. Trout will often strike hard when they feel a lure darting past. Sometimes, though, they'll tap it, so keep a sharp feel for any change in pressure or rhythm. When the surface bite slows, that's the time to break out soft plastics under popping corks. This setup offers a perfect combination of flash, sound, and suspended movement. In clear water, go with natural tones like shrimp and sand colors. In murkier surf, chartreuse or glowtails often get hit. Cast well beyond the breakers, then pop and pause your cork to imitate struggling prey. Trout often hit on the pause, so be ready. The beauty of the popping cork rig is its simplicity. It keeps the lure in the strike zone longer and helps draw fish in from a distance, even in light chop. For those looking for truly large trout, jetties at dawn hold real promise. These bigger fish often patrol the edges where bait flushes through and where light and shadow meet. It's a sight fishing opportunity if the water's clear and the sun hasn't climbed too high. Use polarized sunglasses, stay low and quiet, and keep an eye out for movement near the rocks. A carefully placed topwater plug can draw explosive strikes if the timing and placement are right. But one wrong step or sloppy cast can shut the bite down. Keep in mind, stealth is key. There's something timeless about fishing the surf this way. It's not about complicated rigs or high-speed reels. It's about timing. It's about matching your bait and presentation to what the fish are naturally doing. You'll often see mullet leaping in panic, shrimp scattering, or birds working bait balls. Those are your signals. The Texas surf offers both simplicity and complexity. You can spend all day chasing shadows, or you can slow down and let the rhythm of the coast lead you to the fish. Target redfish around structure at high tide with fresh bait and patience. Trust your live bait and don't overwork it. When trout move in, follow the slicks, present lures with precision, and adapt to their activity level with popping corks or topwaters. And above all, be there early. The best action happens before the crowds, before the sun gets too high, and while the surf is still fishable. Trout fishing will decline in the surf as fall wears on, with redfish staying strong. And with Texas weather, you can't go by calendars to gauge summer or fall, sometimes well into October. Get out there and read the water with specks and reds in mind, and keep these tips in mind to score a Texas-sized catch. Thanks for listening.
Oasis of Bowed Up Rods, Going Coastal, by Kelly Gross, Texas Fish and Game contributing editor. South Texas is a true outdoorsman's paradise, especially during the late summer and beginning of fall. This is my favorite time of year and favorite few fishing months to chase any and everything, especially big snook and tarpon. Mornings consisting of yellowfin snook, inhaling topwaters and silver-gilded tarpon flying out of the water, to afternoons hunting white-winged dove over vast fields of sunflowers are hard to beat. Outdoor enthusiasts from all over the state and country flood to South Texas to cast a line and hunt for dove next to the border. It's a beautiful time of year. This time last year was a great season for big snook, with some of the largest being caught that I've witnessed. My clients and I had several 38s and 39ins caught and released on both artificial and live baits, said Captain Brian Barrera, who targets snook all times of the year. Early bird gets the worm is a tried and true statement, and certainly applies to snook fishing. Right at daylight last year, Captain Barrera and I were starting the day right by chasing some bigs. The night before, I had picked out a flashy Miralure pink and silver CI Pro Dog Junior topwater. Pink topwaters have always been my go-to, and the ones I've had the most luck catching hungry breeder fish on. Schools of mullet were being chased and fleeing amongst the rocky edge during an outgoing tide, and you could hear loud whooshes of water letting us know that predators were feeding. I casted my Shimano GLF-76 medium-heavy rod, rigged with the Miralure topwater on 30-pound leader about 2 feet from the rocky edge, thinking that it wasn't the best cast, and I could have been a little bit closer to the wall. I slowly walked the lure back towards the boat along with the current, and after about 4 twitches, a massive humpback breached behind my lure, and a snook inhaled my topwater. The fish immediately jumped once it was hooked, and we could tell it was a large one, but as it got closer to the boat, we saw it was a very large one, 39-inch on the tape. A 39-inch snook is a great catch in Florida, and especially here in Texas where snook have been on the rise. Texas Parks and Wildlife surveys show an increase in snook in our bays on the lower coast, and seeing more of these larger fish is a great sign of our fishery. I can't wait to get that replica mount on my wall. September and October are also top months for chasing tarpon. The Silver King migrates annually from the Yucatan up to Louisiana, but this time of year any tarpon caught will most likely be on their way back south to Mexico. They tend to stop and hang around the lower Laguna Madre area, as the waters will still be warm and bait will be plentiful. Last season during these months, some of the largest tarpon, 200 pounds and up, were being caught. Bulldogs, as we like to refer to them, putting on brutal yet magical fights. Artificials like AM Fishing's 5.5-inch, 7-inch jerk shads definitely seem to be the ticket last season, but one thing I've learned most about tarpon fishing is that they are very stubborn. Their unpredictable nature is what makes chasing this species so addicting and rewarding. Those slick, calm days where a giant comes blasting from the ocean's calm surface never gets old. I think the hair on my arms stood up just writing that. Thanks to Mother Lagoon, late summer and fall in South Texas is a true oasis for those seeking bowed-up rods and drag-screaming reels. Happy fishing and hunting this season. Until next time, email Kelly Gross at contactus@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening.
Running for Cover. Texas Freshwater by Matt Williams, Texas Fish and Game, Freshwater Fishing Editor. Give them cover and bass will come. I thought about the connection pretty often while watching some of the nation's top pros pick apart the shallows during Bassmaster Live coverage of the Elite Series event held earlier this month on the Sabine River in Orange. Nothing was off limits as the anglers plied the cover-rich river system for some of the tiniest bass anyone saw, brought to the scales in a big league fishing tournament all season long. A 2-pounder was a fish to get genuinely excited about on the Sabine. A 3-pounder was considered a tank. Tournament winner Pat Schlapper did a great job of exploiting bass hanging around the river's wealth of skinny water cover, including sticks-ups, lay-down logs, metal pipes, flooded reeds, bushes, and cypress trees. He relied on a number of tactics to grab the $100,000 top prize with what turned out to be the lowest winning weight ever recorded in Elite Series history, 38 pounds, 12 ounces. Though the fish were small, it was truly refreshing to watch the majority of the top finishers spend 4 days hoping instead of scoping. One of the event's most classic topwater strikes was caught on camera in the final round as Schlapper worked his way down a backwater canal flanked by reeds, hyacinth, and other greenery. About 90 seconds into the segment, a solid 2-pounder smacked Schlapper's buzzbait just as it passed between a pair of stick-ups about 10 yards from shore. The fish was obviously hanging tight to the isolated wood and mistook the buzzbait for an easy meal passing overhead. The lesson here, bass are cover nuts. Not only does cover provide fish with shade and security, it also makes a good hideout for waging attacks on unsuspecting prey that swims dangerously close. Here's a synopsis of a few types of shallow cover anglers should never overlook. Docks, piers, and boat slips. Boat docks, boathouses, and piers will attract fish year-round. On some lakes, particularly those that lack in aquatic vegetation, boat docks may be the most attractive form of shallow cover. Bass love to hold tight to support pilings, but they will also gang up around man-made brush piles staged around docks and piers by property owners. This is also a good place to find other predators like catfish and crappie. Something else to consider about docks and piers is water depth. Structures built on points and shorelines in close proximity to an abrupt drop-off and creek channel swing can be particularly attractive for bass. Go natural. Just about every lake has its share of lay-down logs, stumps, and/or standing timber. All three provide bass with suitable hangouts, such as mangled limbs and gnarly root systems. It's always a good idea to fish as tight to the wood as possible. Crash the bait into it if you can. Oftentimes, this is what triggers the strike. When fishing around a laydown log, be sure to make numerous casts to it from different angles. Oftentimes, that is what it takes to trigger a strike from a fish that is holding super tight to the wood or one that is reluctant to chase. Bass in the bushes. Flooded bushes like willows or buckbrush can be super attractive to bass provided water levels are sufficient. Bushes always get lots of attention during the spring months, when water levels tend to be high and there are lots of fish in the shallows. When water levels fall out of the bushes, the bush bite tends to go away with it. Location can have an impact on which bushes will hold bass and which ones won't. As a rule, isolated bushes on main lake points, secondary points, or near channel breaks are more likely to hold fish than bushes found along a straightaway shoreline or an open flat with no definitive changes in contour nearby. Tire breakwaters. Large marinas sometimes place rows of big tires at strategic locations to help protect facilities from destructive wave action created by high winds and big boats. These man-made breakwaters can be magnets for bass because of the cover and shade they provide. The best plans of attack are to throw moving baits along the edges or penetrate the bowels with a drop bait like a jig or Texas rig. Grass, pads, and hay. Aquatic vegetation is always a good place to look for bass. Hydrilla, torpedo grass, sometimes called hay grass, and lily pads are among the most common types in East Texas reservoirs. Hydrilla roots to the bottom and forms dense surface mats and distinctive edges where it meets with water that is too deep for it to grow. Fish often set up along the edges of the grass to ambush prey. Lily pads resemble giant sand dollars and are rooted to bottom with individual stalks. Growth can be spotty, but it is not uncommon for thousands of pads to form shady canopies over shallow flats during warm weather months. Hay grass roots along the shoreline. It is lush green during the warm weather months and is capable of growing out to depths of 5 feet or more in stable water conditions. It's very resilient and can withstand extreme cold as well as low and high water situations. Not every piece of cover in the lake will hold a hungry bass, but a bunch of it will. Never hesitate to pick it apart. There is no telling what might be lurking in the shadows. Email Matt Williams at contactus@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. Dodging a Bullet on Public Land Loss. Feature article by Chester Moore. Last June, a little notice provision buried deep in a federal budget reconciliation package set off alarm bells across the outdoor community. Tucked away in the lengthy legislative text was a proposal to sell or transfer between 2 and 3 million acres of public land currently overseen by the Bureau of Land Management and the U.S. Forest Service. Had the measure passed, it would have represented one of the largest reductions in federally managed land access in decades. The proposal arrived without warning and offered few specifics, including no list of parcels, no public hearings, and no clear justification. Just a sweeping attempt to dispose of land that millions of Americans rely on for hunting, fishing, hiking, camping, and wildlife conservation. By embedding it within a budget reconciliation bill, Congress could bypass normal procedures, including public input and committee review. With a simple majority vote, it could have become law. But by July 9th, the measure was withdrawn after intense opposition from across the country. Hunters, anglers, conservation advocates, and grassroots voices came together to push back hard and fast. Though the proposal failed this time, the episode revealed just how vulnerable public lands can be and how quickly they can come under threat. The reaction was swift. Advocacy groups mobilized their members, outdoor enthusiasts contacted their representatives, and social media lit up with calls to action. Though the exact motivations behind the land sale provision remain unclear, critics widely saw it as a test balloon, an attempt to quietly open the door for future large-scale transfers or privatization efforts. What concerned many wasn't just the potential loss of access or habitat, it was the dangerous precedent sidestepping public input in decisions that affect millions of acres of shared land. For Texans, the situation struck a particular nerve. With over 97% of land in the state under private ownership, public lands are extremely limited and deeply valued. Tracts such as the Sam Houston National Forest, the LBJ National Grasslands, and various coastal wildlife refuges provide some of the only affordable and accessible options for everyday Texans to enjoy the outdoors. Losing even a portion of those places felt personal to many who rely on the land, not just for hunting, fishing, hiking, and camping, but for a connection to land and tradition. In many western states, hunters can access vast expanses of public terrain. In Texas, however, most outdoor opportunities come at a cost. Lease prices have risen steeply, and private land access is increasingly out of reach for younger or lower-income sportsmen and women. For that reason, every acre of federal land is a lifeline. The idea that these rare public spaces could be quietly transferred or sold without a word of public input outraged many across the Lone Star State. Opponents of the proposal also highlighted the broader implications for wildlife. Federally managed lands serve as critical habitat for countless species, from migratory birds to game animals like elk, turkey, and deer. These areas support not just biodiversity, but also the economic engine of outdoor recreation, which contributes billions annually to local economies. If privatized or fragmented, those landscapes become harder to manage and less resilient to threats like climate change, development, and invasive species. The proposal also reignited long-standing concerns about how public lands are managed and how decisions about them are made. Many in the outdoor community believe that while land management policies can and should evolve, major changes must be transparent, deliberate, and rooted in science, not hidden in obscure budget language. The fast-tracked nature of reconciliation, which limits debate and amendment, made this particular proposal even more troubling. In the weeks after the provision surfaced, citizens flooded Capitol Hill with emails, letters, and phone calls. Outdoor writers, small-town outfitters, rural hunters, and weekend campers alike joined a broad chorus of resistance. In a rare moment of unity, voices across political and geographic lines demanded the measure be removed. That groundswell of opposition ultimately led to the provision's defeat. Still, no one is celebrating too loudly. The fact that such a sweeping policy came so close to becoming law without any public input has left many outdoor advocates wary. The concern now is that similar language could reappear in future budget bills or be pushed through by other means through executive action, regulatory changes, or another legislative shortcut. In the wake of the crisis, a number of recurring priorities have emerged. Outdoor advocates want clear prohibitions against using reconciliation or other non-transparent processes to authorize land sales or transfers. They're calling for stronger safeguards around public land protections, including laws that require environmental justification, public consultation, and congressional oversight for any significant transfer of federally managed land. There is also a growing push to modernize how public lands are managed. Many conservationists argue that outdated policies and bureaucratic delays have slowed habitat restoration, trail maintenance, wildfire mitigation, and access improvements. Updating these systems while keeping lands in public hands would help ensure they remain viable and resilient for generations to come. The Land and Water Conservation Fund, long considered one of the most effective tools for improving access and protecting landscapes, continues to be a central part of this vision. With stronger investment and a clear national strategy, advocates believe that the U.S. can both protect existing public lands and expand access in underserved areas, especially in places like Texas, where opportunities are scarce. Ultimately, what stopped the proposal was public engagement. Everyday hunters, anglers, hikers, and wildlife enthusiasts raised their voices and demanded accountability. Their action made the difference, but it also showed that vigilance is the price of access. Public lands, no matter how vast, are never immune to political maneuvering. They require defenders. The lesson is simple. Speak up early, speak up often, and don't assume that others will do it for you. Whether it's a small parcel in East Texas or a sprawling wilderness in Montana, these lands belong to everyone, and if they're not protected, they can be lost. Thanks for listening. The Beginning, Texas Whitetails, by Larry Wysoon, Texas Fish and Game, Whitetail Hunting Editor. Coming left. 7 or 8 mourning doves within 20 yards, I shouldered my Mossberg 410 gauge, swung past the lead bird, and pulled the trigger. Down it went. 2 dove wing beats later, I swung through a second dove, pulled the trigger on the bottom barrel. Gracious, didn't think you even knew what a shotgun was, nor how to shoot one. I smiled and pretended like it happened every time I pulled a shotgun's trigger. After picking up both doves, I'll see you at dark. Gonna go hunt that little waterhole at the Turner Windmill. 20 minutes later, I sat down next to a gnarly bull mesquite, laid my over-under shotgun at my side, and pulled my stealth vision binocular from my backpack. Time to get down to serious business, and the real reason I was hunting doves was to scout for whitetails, watching a waterhole where earlier in the year I had picked up a matched set of sheds. With a 17-inch inside spread, the rack would have gross Boone and Crockett scored in the 160s. While others were shooting at mourning doves, I watched bucks, does, and fawns coming to water and taking bites of the Vineyard Max, www.vineyardmax.net. I had poured on the ground, several small piles around the small waterhole. The sun had dropped into the mesquites 25 minutes ago. I was about to leave when I spotted movement walking toward the waterhole. Binocs up. It was a really good buck, with antlers that looked a lot like the sheds I had found, only bigger. I watched as he cautiously approached the shallow spillover pond set up specifically for wildlife water, as evidenced by not only the deer, but also the many mourning doves, bobwhite quail, and songbirds that had come to water there that afternoon. I watched as he drank. He was old, at least 7. His beams were massive and as big around as his earbuds. All other circumferences were bigger than his eye, which would measure 4 inches in circumference. 4 tines looked to be twice the length of eye to the tip of his nose measurement, 6 to 7 inches. His front tines and his brow tines were equal to that measure. When he turned to leave, he stopped and listened intently to something in front of him. His forward erect ears, based on measurements I had taken in the past on numerous hunter-harvested area bucks, were easily 15 inches plus another half of that measurement, likely 20 inches inside spread. He was one I wanted. I knew my best chance of taking that particular buck would be at the first legal opportunity while he was still in his late summer pattern before the initiation of the rut. I am not a bow hunter, nor do I own a crossbow. The property at the time was not yet set up under a Texas-managed land deer permit. I really wanted a chance at that buck. I would have to procure a crossbow and learn the capabilities of it and my capabilities with it. The following week, I had a 10-point crossbow, complete with a full complement of bolts, tipped with Sever broadheads. Unlike my bolt and lever-action rifles, topped with stealth vision scopes loaded with Hornady ammo, or my .44 mag or .454 Kazal Taurus Raging Hunter revolvers, also shooting Hornady loads, hunting with a crossbow required a whole new set of learnings. Wish I could tell you I shot the Turner Windmill buck that fall. It did not happen, but not because of a lack of time spent hunting him. I did not see him again until after the hunting season closed. This year, things are different. The property is now under a MLD permit. I'll not be hunting that property with a crossbow. I will use it on another property where I can only sling arrows. This October, I will hunt with my Mossberg 7mm PRC rifle with Avient rapid heat releasing barrel, topped with a stealth vision scope, shooting Hornady precision hunter ammo, ready for action, come the first day of the Texas managed land deer permit season. If I happen to take my targeted buck this fall, you will hear my Aggie victory yell no matter where you live. September is the ideal time to do your preseason whitetail scouting. From all I could learn earlier, 2025 will be an excellent antler year. In most areas of Texas, deer are in great body condition. I see lots of delicious venison-based meals in our future. By the latter part of October, I'll be hunting in northeast Texas using my rattling horns. Last year, I rattled in numerous bucks southeast of the Dallas-Fort Worth area, which has become one of my favorite hunting areas. If you love hunting like I do, it is once again our time of the year. All the best of days afield. Email Larry, why soon at contactus at fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. Hidden dove and duck options. How to find great wing shooting locations away from crowds on public land. Feature article by Matt Williams. Let's face it, when it comes to big water fishing holes, there just aren't many secrets anymore. Much the same can be said for duck and dove hunting sweet spots on public hunting lands. One careless social media post or slip of the tongue amongst big ears these days is all it takes to call in the troops and ruin a great hunting spot that may have taken years to locate. My old friend Shannon Tompkins of Porter knows a thing or two about wing shooting on public lands. Tompkins, 71, grew up in Baytown and spent 4 decades as a newspaper outdoors writer before retiring from the Houston Chronicle in 2019. Tompkins has traversed lots of country over the years and enjoyed some banner shoots along the way, many of them on public lands and waters. While finding unmolested hotspots doesn't seem as easy today as it once was, he says there are still some gems out there waiting to be discovered by ambitious hunters willing to put forth the effort it takes to find them. Following are some bullet points Tompkins offered up on the topic. A lot of this stuff is just common sense, Tompkins said. But some of it comes hard won from almost 60 years of chasing waterfowl and doves in Texas, most of it on public areas. Good work ethic. Tompkins says hunters need to be willing to invest the time, research, and the road miles to find decent out-of-the-way or high-quality public spots. It's a lot of work and expense. The farther away a spot is from a population center, the better chance of it being unmolested by other hunters, he said. Networking a plus. Building a small network of like-minded, trustworthy folks with whom to share personal information and ideas can be a big help, but it's wise to avoid discussions on internet chat rooms. Intimate networks can provide valuable connections for learning about current habitat conditions, bird numbers, and hunting prospects in areas that may be too far from home base to be scouted on your own. Tompkins says he has had friends who live hours away contact him with valuable information about public hunting spots that were prime for hunting at the time. It's impossible to gather real-time intel like that without taking the huge risk of driving long distances, only to be cruelly and expensively disappointed once you get there, he said. Dedication. Be willing to work harder, walk farther, scout harder, hide better, stay longer than the other guys. Buy an APH permit. At only $48, a TPWD annual public hunting permit can be a great investment. The permit grants legal access to more than 180 tracts statewide, totaling more than 1 million acres. Plus, permit holders are eligible to participate in drawn hunts on wildlife management areas overseen by the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, some of which can provide top-shelf wing shooting. The hunts are well-run, the number of permits are limited, and hunters have designated areas compartments that only they may hunt, Tompkins said. It makes for a super high-quality experience. Additionally, Tompkins says the APH can open up opportunities to find isolated oxbows and sloughs on national forest lands that can provide some stellar shoots for wood ducks, mallards, gadwall, and teal. As with all public hunting, the first trick is finding these isolated wetlands, he said. Aerial maps have made this much easier, but it is crucial to scout them and to learn how weather conditions and patterns affect the landscape. A wet year can create duck-friendly wetlands where none exist during dry years. A dry year can evaporate last season's hotspot. WMA Dove Sweet Spots. Tompkins says wildlife management areas located in deep South Texas offer some world-class dove hunting opportunities with very limited pressure at times. Some of his favorites are found in the Rio Grande Valley. It's crucial to either scout those areas yourself or have contacts who can do that and willing to share their information, Tompkins said. Cold weather doves. While dove hunting always gets the most play from hunters in late summer, early fall, Tompkins says winter seasons offer some golden opportunities on public land that often go overlooked by the masses. The winter seasons don't draw the numbers of hunters the September opener pulls, but with the influx of wintering doves, the number of birds can be just as spectacular, he said. I've had great winter season dove shoots on WMAs and other public tracks in South Texas, particularly around waterholes, and in central and coastal Texas around fields holding croton, sunflower, pigweed, and other hard native seeds that provide much of wintering dove's forage. Coastal gems. Tompkins says Texas' vast coastline offers some of the best opportunities for a waterfowler to find isolated sweet spots that aren't overrun with other hunters. Just don't expect good fortune to come easy. Long boat rides to isolated spots 10 to 20 miles from the nearest ramp, usually in the dark and often in nasty weather conditions, sometimes lead to the best hunts, he said. These kinds of expeditions take extensive planning and may involve overnight primitive camping on sandy shorelines or rough oyster reefs. River tricks. Tompkins says it's possible to enjoy some exceptional hunting along shallow flats and calm eddies on larger rivers that are frequently used as travel corridors by migrant waterfowl. The tricks are locating such areas, learning how water levels affect huntability and bird behavior, and being careful to avoid any violations of trespass laws and hunting regulations. Also, take into consideration there's a very high probability landowners adjacent to the area hunted will not be happy to find someone hunting along their stretch of the river and will confront the hunters or call law enforcement to address the issue, he said. River hunters should be very careful, use discretion, and expect to be confronted. For most, it's not worth the hassle and the potential for things to go sideways. Thanks for listening. The Scariest Animals in Texas. Feature article by Chester Moore. Texas is a hunting and fishing paradise, but it's also home to some of the most dangerous wildlife hunters are likely to encounter anywhere in North America. While most hunters are tuned into wind shifts and game movement, it's easy to forget that the outdoors has teeth, venom, and disease waiting in the shadows. From the pine forests to coastal marshes, these five threats deserve more attention from anyone heading into the field. Feral hogs. There's no bigger physical threat in the Texas backcountry than feral hogs. With numbers estimated at over 2.5 million and rising, feral swine have become the most encountered and most unpredictable large mammals in the state. While most hunters encounter them through hog hunts or game camera footage, the real danger comes when things get personal. Feral hogs are fast, muscular, and equipped with sharp tusks capable of inflicting devastating injuries. If wounded, cornered, or protecting young, they won't hesitate to charge. Fatalities are rare, but they do happen. In 2019, a woman named Christine Rollins was killed outside a home in Anahuac. She was attacked and mauled by a group of hogs in the early morning hours, according to the Chambers County Sheriff. It was a gruesome reminder that these animals are not just crop-destroying nuisances, they can be lethal. That attack took place in a front yard, not deep in the wilderness. Imagine what can happen in a tight thicket at dusk with no line of retreat. For hunters stalking deer, trailing blood, or recovering downed game in heavy cover, the possibility of flushing a sounder is real. Being alert, armed, and mentally prepared to handle an unexpected hog encounter is just as important as shot placement. Western diamondback rattlesnake. In much of Texas, especially in the hill country, South Texas brush, and desert regions, the western diamondback rattlesnake is the dominant venomous species. It's also the most dangerous snake hunters are likely to come across, due both to its widespread distribution and its potent venom. Diamondbacks are ambush predators that rely on camouflage and stealth. Often, they won't rattle until it's too late or won't rattle at all. Many bites occur when someone steps near a coiled snake in tall grass or reaches under a log or blind without checking. The bite itself can cause severe tissue damage, internal bleeding, and even death if left untreated. The good news is that fatalities are rare due to widespread access to antivenom. The bad news? Getting to that treatment in time can be a serious problem if you're in a remote lease or deep in our limited public land country. Before sitting in a blind or popping up a ground setup, it's smart to do a full check for snakes, even in cooler months when they may still be active on warm afternoons. Black-legged deer tick. Unlike the other threats on this list, deer ticks don't strike with speed or force, but they may be the most dangerous animal a hunter can encounter, and they're often unnoticed until it's too late. The black-legged tick, commonly known as the deer tick, is the primary vector for Lyme disease. While Texas doesn't see the same volume of confirmed Lyme cases as the Northeast, the risk is very real and growing. Other tick-borne illnesses, including ehrlichiosis and southern tick-associated rash illness, STERI, also present serious health threats in Texas. A tick bite is painless. Many hunters brush through tall grass, sit on logs, or crawl through leaves during stalks or setups, giving ticks the perfect opportunity to latch on. Once attached, they can go unnoticed for 24 to 48 hours, which is the window needed for Lyme transmission to occur. Symptoms don't always show up right away, but when they do, they can include severe fatigue, joint pain, heart problems, and neurological effects. Some cases lead to months or years of health problems. And in many parts of Texas, Lyme and tick-borne illness awareness is still lacking among both doctors and hunters. The best defense is treating clothing with permethrin, using repellents containing DEET or picaridin, and doing thorough tick checks after every hunt. This is a silent threat that requires proactive habits, not reactive care. Stingrays. For anglers and bay-hunting waterfowlers, stingrays are an often overlooked but serious danger. These flat-bodied fish lie buried in soft sand and mud, perfectly camouflaged in shallow water. Step on one, and its whip-like tail will lash upward, driving a venomous barb deep into the leg or foot. The injury itself is incredibly painful. The stingray's barb can tear muscle, sever tendons, and deliver venom that causes intense burning pain and swelling. If the barb breaks off under the skin as it often does, it can lead to infection or require surgical removal. The risk isn't limited to summer wade fishing. Stingray strikes can and do happen during early morning teal hunts, marsh scouting trips, and when retrieving downed birds. The best prevention is simple but essential: the stingray shuffle. By sliding your feet along the bottom instead of stepping, you give the ray a chance to move off. Many seasoned hunters also wear ray guard boots or leggings when wading in high-risk areas. Awareness and foot discipline are the difference between a routine hunt and an emergency extraction. Feral dogs. The danger posed by feral dogs is growing quietly and rapidly. These are not lost pets. They're wild animals that have either escaped or been dumped, and they've adapted to life in the woods and on the edge of civilization. Some form packs, others roam solo, but all have the potential to be dangerous. Unlike coyotes, which generally avoid humans, feral dogs can be aggressive, territorial, and bold. There have been incidents of hunters being stalked or confronted by these animals, especially near food sources like feeders, gut piles, or bait sites. Some carry diseases, including rabies and distemper, and most won't show typical fear of humans. They're also often armed with familiarity, as they know how people move, how blinds are set up, and where deer are being patterned. That combination of wild instinct and domestic awareness can make for a very unpredictable threat. It's wise to carry a sidearm in areas where feral dog encounters are possible. Hunters running dogs, especially hounds or retrievers, should be extremely cautious when operating in areas where feral packs have been spotted. Final thoughts. The reality is simple. While Texas outdoors lovers enter the wild in search of game, they often forget the wild may be hunting too. Preparation, situational awareness, and gear suited for more than the target species are what keep a hunter in control when things go sideways. Every one of these threats is manageable, but they're also real. Treat them as seriously as any trophy buck, and you'll return from the field safe and smarter for the next trip. Thanks for listening. Top-notch hunting. Larry Wysoon and Lou Marullo, the Fish and Game Profile Series. For decades, Lou Marullo has guided tens of thousands of Texans through the intricacies of hunting and bow hunting. He's not only Texas Fish and Game's hunting editor, but also a master bow hunter education instructor, deeply committed to hunter safety and education. Marullo's column, Bare Bones Hunting, brims with practical tips, sharp wit, and genuine enthusiasm. One memorable piece declares, "Oh, the fishing season is most definitely in high gear, but for those who like to pull a trigger or a bowstring, hunting season never ends." In the off-season, he chronicles summer pursuits, hog-dogging, shed hunting, and scouting for exotics with the same energy as traditional autumn deer chases, or one of his favorite pursuits, turkey hunting. He's openly confessed to owning an abundance of tree stands, turkey calls, camo gear, and boots. What resonates throughout his columns is his blend of honesty, playful self-deprecation, and unwavering love for the outdoors. Whether testing new gear, writing about blind setups, or detailing summer hog hunts, Marullo's work is rooted in lived experience and true hunter passion. Marullo has always been popular with TF&G readers. Some of the comments we've gotten over the years include, "I feel like Lou Marullo is my hunting mentor. I'm always learning practical tips. He always teaches me something and makes me laugh. You can tell when a guy really likes it and it's obvious he's really a hunter." He is author and narrator of the ebook String Theory for Bow Hunting, and while he hunts with rifle and shotgun when necessary, he always prefers the bow. If Marullo is the voice of education and gear-tested enthusiasm, Larry Weishhuhn is the heart of whitetail management. Known widely as Mr. Whitetail, Weishhuhn brings a lifetime of hands-on wildlife biology and ethical deer hunting to Texas Fish and Game's Texas Whitetails column. A Texas A&M-trained wildlife scientist, he began publishing in the 1970s and later served as a TPWD technical assistance biologist. He's also co-founder of the Texas Wildlife Association and established Quality Management Limited, helping restore and manage wildlife habitat across millions of acres. Weishhuhn's knowledge of whitetails extends beyond hunting, as he is a huge advocate for deer nutrition and management. Beyond print, Weishhuhn writes books, serves as a field editor for major hunting publications, and appears regularly on radio and TV, including Campfire Talk and A Sportsman's Life. His ethical stance is clear when he says, "We need to be mindful of the impression we leave. We owe that respect to the animals we shoot." He has had a long-standing relationship with the Dallas Safari Club Foundation and invests much time in promoting hunter advocacy and conservation. Between Lou Marullo's gear-tested energy and years of bow hunter safety instruction, and Larry Weishhuhn's legendary whitetail knowledge, ethical advocacy, and habitat management, Texas Fish and Game readers enjoy a strong mix of education, passion, and conservation. Thanks for listening. Crossbow or compound? Which is best for your hunting situation? Feature article by Dustin Vaughn Warnke. When I first stepped into the world of crossbows back in 2009, it completely reshaped my understanding of bow hunting. Over the years, I've become passionate about sharing what I've learned with both seasoned hunters and newcomers alike. While crossbows bring a lot of advantages, there are a few key essentials every crossbow owner should have in their kit. Don't worry, these aren't fancy or expensive add-ons, but practical tools that can make all the difference in the field. First and foremost, invest in a solid shooting rest. Since most hunts require some level of mobility, I prefer a bipod or monopod that's lightweight and easy to carry. A good rest helps you maintain a stable shooting platform, whether you're sitting, kneeling, or standing. Even the most accurate shooter can miss without a steady base. Next, a quality rope cocking device is a must. I learned this lesson the hard way early on. I used to cock my crossbow by hand, and one uneven pull led to a misfire that cost me a trophy buck. Ever since, I've relied on rope cockers or crank systems, and I suggest using one made specifically for your model. Proper string alignment is critical for accuracy and safety. Finally, don't overlook regular maintenance. Keep your rail lubricated and your string waxed to reduce wear and extend the life of your equipment. Some waxes can serve both purposes, and you can purchase them separately. Either way, a little care goes a long way. In the end, accuracy is what matters, whether you're targeting paper at the range or a game animal in the woods. A stable rest, reliable cocking method, and well-maintained gear are the foundation of successful crossbow hunting. Practice consistently, shoot confidently, and enjoy every moment in the field. Crossbow or compound bow, which is right for you? If you're just getting into archery hunting, one of the biggest choices you'll face is whether to go with a crossbow or a compound bow. Each has its strengths, and the decision depends on your physical ability, hunting style, and preferences. Crossbows are great for hunters who want a more rifle-like experience. Once cocked, they're ready to fire with minimal movement, making them ideal for ground blinds or tree stands where stealth is crucial. They also often require less strength to hold at full draw, which is especially helpful for older hunters or those with shoulder limitations. Compound bows, on the other hand, offer more challenge and tradition. They're lighter, quieter, and provide a faster follow-up shot. They also typically require more practice to master due to the draw and hold mechanics. If you enjoy the process and want a more physically engaging experience, a compound bow might be for you. Ultimately, the right choice comes down to what feels most natural and effective for your hunting goals. Whichever you choose, both tools can be lethal, ethical, and deeply rewarding when used with discipline and respect for the game. Thanks for listening. Cast and Blast. A look at the wealth of fall hook and bullet options waiting for Lone Star anglers and hunters. Fish and Game Special Section. There's no better time to be a Texas outdoorsman than when summer starts slipping and the air gets that first nip of fall. That's when the real season begins, and not just for one thing, but for everything. Birds in the air, fish in the water, deer in the brush. You can chase it all if you've got the time and the gas money. September rolls in like a dust cloud behind a ranch truck. Early teal are the first shot across the bow. When the birds are in, they're thick, blue wings screaming low across the ponds, cutting sharp over decoys at daylight. You can set up on a slough in East Texas or a flooded pasture down south and burn through a box of shells before the coffee cools. Once that's over, swap the waders for sneakers and grab a rod. Creeks are still warm and bass hang tight in shady pockets, fish slow and near cover. A soft plastic fluke or small spinnerbait will get it done. It's a good way to burn the rest of the morning while the smell of spent shells still hangs in the air. If you're farther south, white-winged doves are the game. Hondo, Uvalde, all that brush country starts popping around mid-month. You'll see birds pouring in just before sunset, especially if you're set up near a waterhole or a cut cornfield. Once you hit your limit, pack it up and head for the coast. Redfish are tailing in the Laguna Madre, working the flats as the tide falls. You don't need anything fancy. Gold spoon, weedless paddle tail, something you can cast a mile and keep moving. Fish it fast and cover ground. If you're lucky, you'll still be cleaning birds when you pull a slot red out of the ice chest. October tightens up. Dove season's still open in most places, but the birds are sharper. They've seen some things. You'll work harder for limits, but it's worth it. That same month, the flounders start to push out of the marsh. Find them stacked in the cuts and drains. Fish a falling tide with a heavy jig and a strip of gulp or mullet if you've got it. They're hungry, and they'll thump it. It's also a great time to slip into the hill country and chase exotics. Axis deer don't care much about the seasons. If they're hot, they're hot. Catch one moving through a cedar flat in the morning, then float the Llano or Guadalupe River for smallmouth and stocker trout. Cool water, light tackle, and nobody around. Not a bad way to spend a Saturday. By November, the ducks start stacking in. Coastal marshes light up early. Pintail, gadwall, redheads. If you're set up right and the wind's with you, you'll see a mixed bag. Hunt the first light, and as soon as the sun climbs, ease out and follow the birds. Gulls, that is. They'll lead you to feeding trout and reds chasing shrimp. It's sight fishing heaven when it's on. The whitetail rut is creeping in. Public land hunts get real serious. Shoot a buck in the morning, catch a stringer of crappie by lunch, and maybe you're starting to see how this cast and blast life works. Come December, the ducks are in full force. Inland potholes, flooded timber, rice fields, or take your pick. Mallards and gadwall are cruising heavy, and those cold fronts will dump new birds every week. Meanwhile, bass fishing starts to pick back up, especially deep. Jigging ledges or pitching big worms into heavy cover will get you bit, even when the surface temp drops. if you drew the Powderhorn WMA cast and blast permit, that's about as good as it gets. Duck hunt the bay in the morning, fish the afternoon tides, then hunt deer or hogs as the sun goes down. That's Texas outdoor living at its absolute peak. January hits, and folks start winding down. Not us. Geese are flying thick down near El Campo and Eagle Lake. Big spreads, layout blinds, and that big sky full of specks and snows, it'll make a believer out of anyone. After the morning shoot, drive north and get on Texoma. Stripers love that cold water. Drift live shad or troll deep with sassy shads. It's not finesse fishing, it's hold-on-tight fishing. February's a strange one. The weather can go either way, but snipe are in thick along the coast and marsh edges. They fly low, fast, and in tight quarters. Real shooting, not just sky-busting. When they've moved on or the shells run out, go chase redfish in the same marsh. The water's clear, the fish are spooky, but if you keep your costs low and your shadows short, you'll find them. March eases the curtain down, gobblers start talking, and if you play your cards right, you can get on a tom before breakfast and a solid bass bite by noon. Shad are spawning in the backs of creeks, and everything's eating. Spinnerbaits, chatterbaits, squarebills, throw it shallow and burn it. It's spring knocking on the door, but there's still time for one more combo run. The thing is, Texas doesn't ask you to choose. You don't have to be just a deer hunter or just a redfish guy. You can shoot a limit of teal, take a buck, and hammer a flat full of trout in one weekend if you hustle. The season's long, the land is big, and there's always something flying or biting if you know where to look. Thanks for listening. The Fish and Game Report. News of the outdoor nation. Reported by Texas Fish and Game staff. Oyster license buyback program growing. Of 545 available oyster licenses, Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, TPWD, received 115 commercial oyster boat license offers in round 9 of its oyster license buyback program, which, if all applicants participate, would represent a reduction by 21% of total oyster licenses in the state. TPWD administers voluntary commercial fishing license buyback programs for inshore shrimp, crab, and finfish fisheries, all of which have had a license moratorium since 2005 or earlier. TPWD received authority for an oyster license buyback from the Texas legislature in 2017 and held the first buyback for oyster licenses in 2018. After several years of limited success in purchasing oyster licenses, TPWD changed the approach with the help of key partners. This round offered a fixed rate for the licenses instead of a reverse bid process used in past buyback rounds. The final number of purchase licenses for round 9 will depend on the number of applicants who sign a contract for their oyster boat license to complete the final transaction. Reducing the number of oyster licenses in Texas has remained a top priority for both the oyster industry and various conservation groups. Funds generated from a surcharge on these commercial licenses go to purchase and retire commercial crab, finfish, bait and bay shrimp, and oyster licenses, helping to ensure sustainable and stable populations over the long term. The department intends to purchase all 115 licenses with the help of significant donations from key donors. Earlier this year, the department joined forces with Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation to create a public-private partnership and establish the S. Reed Morian Oyster Buyback Program to raise the funds needed for this latest round of buybacks. A volunteer-led group of conservation-minded individuals and foundations has pledged their support. Key funders include the Lori and S. Reed Morian Foundation, Coastal Conservation Association, the Brown Foundation, the Earl C. Sams Foundation, Jeffrey and Mindy Hildebrand, Beaver and Joni Applin, John and Mary Eads, and Bobby and Sherry Patton. TPWD will be notifying all commercial oyster boat license applicants that they can now begin the next steps to complete the transaction. In other news, new public hunting land opened. With the addition of 3 new properties, Texas's 2025-26 hunting season will offer more public hunting opportunities through Texas Parks and Wildlife Department's TPWD Public Hunting Program. Texas Parks and Wildlife adds 3 properties to public hunting offerings. The Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission authorized 2025-26 hunting season dates for public hunting lands and Texas state parks that will offer 140 different public hunts in 52 state park and state natural areas, totaling more than 521,000 acres of publicly accessible land. We are so excited to be able to continue to grow the public hunting opportunities within state parks and natural areas every year, including on some of the newest park properties, said Greg Creasy, Texas State Parks Natural Resources Program Director. The number of hunted parks has increased from 45 to 52 in the past 5 years. The addition of some of our newest sites, four, including the recent acquisitions at Enchanted Rock State Natural Area and Post Oak Ridge State Park, gives hunters a special opportunity to help the department with land management on these unique properties. The newest additions of acreage added to the public hunting program in Texas state parks include 1,650 acres at Dinosaur Valley State Park, 1,400 acres at Ray Roberts Lake State Park, Isle Du Bois Unit, 3,100 acres at Post Oak Ridge State Park, 3,100 acres at Enchanted Rock State Natural Area, and 1,000 acres at Government Canyon State Natural Area. TPWD's public hunting program includes more than 1 million acres located throughout Texas. Access to these lands is provided by two types of permits: the $48 annual public hunting APH permit, available beginning August 15th. Thanks for listening. The Fall Transition. The Fish and Game Forecast Center. Upper Coast Focus, Sabine Area. Reported by Captain Eddie Hernandez. What an exciting time for outdoorsmen in the great state of Texas. Over the next 2 months, we should experience more of the same hot, muggy conditions that we've grown so accustomed to, as well as a glimpse of the cool autumn conditions that are right around the corner. We really don't know what to expect because it can go from warm to cool and back to warm in the blink of an eye. Regardless, this is the time of year when outdoor enthusiasts across the state are able to switch gears and begin to slowly tweak their angling strategies, as well as start thinking more seriously about upcoming hunting opportunities. Here on Sabine Lake, it is usually more of a gradual transition from traditional summer patterns to those geared more toward fall fishing. We are probably not quite done with the dog days yet, especially in September, and for that reason, a lot of our time will still be spent south of the causeway, working the ship channel and jetties. The topwater bite should remain consistent early and late for the next few weeks, with some impressive stringers of speckled trout and redfish. Once the topwater bite begins to taper off a bit, soft plastics bounced off the bottom on eighth or quarter ouncer's jig head, or about 24 inches under a popping cork, should keep you on the fish. Proven locations with good bait-holding bottoms and fluctuating depths such as Chenier, Golden Pass LNG, and Lighthouse Cove are areas that you want to key on. The abundance of baitfish coupled with very good tidal movement is what keeps these spots at the top of most people's list. The same holds true for the jetties. We've still got a few more weeks of very consistent fishing there also. Again, throwing topwaters early, then switching to soft plastics around mid-morning should result in some nice stringers. Skitter walks and she-dogs in pink silver, bone, and black chartreuse are excellent choices for topwater plugs. Some hard-to-beat soft plastics include Zoom Superfluke, Down South Lures, and DOA series in pink, white ice, and chartreuse. If we're lucky, we'll get a nice cool front in September. Then we can quickly switch into fall fishing mode and take full advantage of a much-welcomed change of pace. The north wind that these early fronts bring gives me visions of shrimp pouring out of the marsh and the mouths of the bayous on the eastern shoreline of Sabine Lake. Fishing the points and mouths of these bayous can be super productive in these conditions. Tidal movement is a very important key to your success. Check the charts and plan your trip accordingly. Be sure to check behind you periodically for working gulls. If we get that early front in September, we'll be out there doing our best to jumpstart the transition from the dog days to some fantastic fall fishing. Come help us get it started. Contact Captain Hernandez at ghgs.eddie@gmail.com or go online to goldenhookguide.com. Thanks for listening. time to hit restart. Fishing game forecast, saltwater. Upper coast focus, Galveston area. By Captain Derek York. Heading into the early fall months is like a restart for a lot of us as far as routines go. The kids are headed back to school, and we are starting to fall back into a routine, just like many of the fish we chase. The redfish are schooling up for their annual spawning season in the nearshore waters. Large schools of surfacing reds can be seen on the beach fronts and in the bays near passes. This will continue into November, usually with fishing being especially good along the jetties and deeper water areas. Targeting redfish this time of year means being prepared. You can catch them up on the surface with topwater lures or by using cut bait and live shrimp near the bottom. Either way, when you find them, you should have a pretty good chance of catching multiple fish. I have had several great trips where we boated between 25 to nearly 50 fish in one day in one spot. This is always a lot of fun with lots of sore arms after the trip is over. Redfish aren't the only thing people are chasing this time of year. Speckled trout are still biting great this time of year, along scattered shell and bigger oyster reefs in the bay. Live bait, soft plastics, and topwater lures all produce great catches. Drift fishing by boat is always a key to success in locating schools of trout and covering lots of water. Wade fishing is also great, especially early in the mornings when the water temps are still tolerable in shallow water. The beachfront is also a top location to cover for speckled trout in September and October. Spoons, live bait, and topwaters are a sure bet in the surf. Regardless of where you are fishing for trout, if you can find bait and some moving water, the fish should be there and be hungry. And when the weather is right, I am still always looking for opportunities to go searching for tripletail and cobia. This year has been pretty good for tripletail so far, with my customers catching them in the bay and offshore. Always take the time to check stuff floating in the water, whether it's a small piece of debris, a crab trap float, or sargassum floating on the surface. You would be surprised by some of the stuff we see them hanging out close to. And the cobia fishing is usually best offshore, with some nice fish being taken next to structure in state waters out to 9 nautical miles. I will typically have a big swim bait or a free-lined live bait rig ready to go. Hopefully, you can get out and enjoy some time on the water this first part of the fall before heading off into the field for hunting season and the football games start up. With less traffic and somewhat, hopefully, cooler temperatures, it is sure to be a good time. Email Captain York at spotstalkerfishing@sbcglobal.com. Thanks for listening. Raining Shrimp. The Fish and Game Forecast Center. Upper Coast Focus. Matagorda Bay Complex. Reported by Captain Mark Talasek. Matagorda has been blessed with an abundance of rain this summer. An influx of fresh water usually means a good fall shrimp crop. That, in return, will make some great fall fishing. When the first cool front rolls through South Texas in September, shrimp start their migration to the Gulf waters. Redfish and trout feed on the shrimp, pushing them to the surface. Seagulls work on the shrimp from the top. It makes finding fish much easier this time of the year. Cast a plastic lure close to some diving seagulls and get ready for a bent rod. Fall fishing can make every fisherman a professional. Locate the birds and you'll find the fish. All indicators are pointing to a spectacular fall, my favorite time of the year. Some of my favorite colors are roach with a chartreuse tail in dirty water and chicken on a chain in clear water. I usually throw a heavier lead head to get deeper. Bigger fish are on the bottom. Limits of trout have been caught in both bays lately. Deep shell has been holding good numbers of slot specks. Live bait has been working well. Regulations on the limit are really helping our trout population. Flounder gigging has been on fire. This has been one of the better years since I started running gigging trips in the 90s. All of my flounder have come from West Bay. Water clarity just hasn't been consistent in East Matagorda. Give me a call to book your next trip. Contact Captain Talasek at marktalasek@sbcglobal.com or go online to talasekguideservice.com. Thanks for listening.
Luring late summer reds. The Fish and Game Forecast Center, Middle Coast Focus, Port O'Connor, reported by Captain Kim Golden. When the Texas heat settles in and the tides turn lazy, redfish along the middle coast kick into full gear. Late summer is prime time for sight casting these bronze bruisers in skinny water, and the best part? You don't need live bait to get it done. With the right lures, timing, and a bit of grit, summer redfish are more than ready to crush artificials. Where to look? Look to marsh drains, grassy flats, and pothole-filled backlakes. On early morning high tides, redfish flood the shoreline grass. As the day heats up and tides fall, they often slide off into deeper cuts or stage near shell patches. Pay close attention to signs: mullet jumping, wakes pushing, or bait nervously scattering. These are your breadcrumbs. Timing is everything. The best bite happens when the sun is low and the water is moving. Early mornings and late evenings offer cooler temps, lower light, and feeding fish. Incoming tides bring bait up into the flats, while outgoing tides funnel it out. Both create natural ambush points. Pair those windows with a steady southeast wind, and you're in business. Go-to lures: 1. Soft plastics. Rigged on 1/16 or 1/8-ounce jig heads, Mir Allure Lil John XLs are deadly. Twitch them through potholes and across grass flats. Natural colors work best in clear water. Darker profiles shine in stained conditions. Some glitter for flash when the sun's overhead works well. 2. Topwaters. Nothing beats the thrill of a redfish violently blowing up a topwater. Walk the dog lures like the Mir Allure She Dog and Mass Custom Lures Single Hook Peanut in Bone, White or Chrome Blue are summertime staples. Fish them slowly with long pauses early, late, and even mid-afternoon. I've spent many a summer afternoon drawing redfish blow-ups in shallow water. 3. Gold Spoons. Flashy, weedless, and classic. A steady retrieve through the grass imitates a fleeing baitfish and triggers reaction strikes. They're ideal for covering water and drawing out ambush predators. 4. Weedless Jerkbaits. Perfect for thick grass or tight marsh pockets. Twitch-twitch paws retrieves mimic injured bait and often draw aggressive hits. Use a light screw-lock hook for a clean presentation. Wade Smart, Travel Light Wade Fishing gives you the stealth advantage. Redfish in shallow water are wary, and one bad footstep can blow your shot. Travel Light Rod, small tackle box, pliers, and a fish bag if you're keeping a fish or two. Good polarized sunglasses are key for spotting fish and reading water depth. Play it forward. Redfish are tough, but they're not limitless. Practice catch photo release when possible. Handle fish with wet hands and keep them in the water as much as you can. Respect the shoreline and leave it cleaner than you found it. Final cast. The Middle Texas coast offers some of the best redfish action all year. Whether you're poling a skiff, stalking a shoreline, or wading the flats, tie on a lure, trust your gut, and go find the redfish. They're waiting, and they're hungry. Contact Captain Golden at kimgoldenfishing@gmail.com or go online to portoconnorfishingtrip.com. Thanks for listening.
Change is in the wind. The Fish and Game Forecast Center, Middle Coast Focus, Upper Laguna Madre, reported by Captain Richard Thompson. September and October are special here, a time of shifting winds, cooling water, and renewed movement among the fish we spend all year thinking about. However, with that said, the trout bite has been on absolute fire on the entire Gulf Coast. As summer loosens its grip and the first hints of fall drift across the Texas coast, anglers along the Upper Laguna Madre and Baffin Bay find themselves at the edge of change. If you've been waiting for an excuse to dust off your wade boots and plan an all-inclusive guided fishing trip and lodging with us, this is it. At R&K Coastal Outfitters, this season is when we see many of our guests catch the fish of a lifetime. And it's also when we spend extra time talking about conservation, because these fisheries need our respect now more than ever. The seasonal shift. Our summer down here started off dry and then later received great rain that naturally ensures that the salinity to fresh water ratios are in balance with each other. By early September, air temperatures finally ease from the 90s into the 80s. Water temperatures steadily fall from the mid-80s into the upper 70s by late October, prompting trout and redfish to move shallower. Wind patterns also transition. Summer's southeast breeze softens, replaced by lighter northeast and occasional early fronts that clean up the water clarity, especially near the land cut and along the King Ranch shoreline. Clean green water and dropping tides concentrate mullet, glass minnows, and shrimp, which in turn draw predators in predictable patterns. Best tactics: wading the flats. At sunrise, slip into the water with a topwater and work sand pockets near grass. As the sun climbs, switch to soft plastics and slow your retrieve. Drifting the expansive flats near Bird Island or Kennedy Ranch remains a proven strategy. Use a drift sock to slow your movement and focus on keeping contact with the bottom. Sight casting. Clear October mornings create perfect conditions to stalk reds in 1 to 2 feet of water. Polarized glasses and patience are your best tools. At R&K Coastal Outfitters, Crystal and myself, and our clients too, most of the time make it a point to release most of our bigger trout and reds. We photograph quick, respectful releases, never holding fish out of the water longer than necessary. These practices are crucial to keeping Baffin Bay's unique trophy fishery thriving. Conservation is not just a buzzword here, it's a commitment. From choosing soft plastics to minimizing fish handling, every small action matters. Why this season shines. If you could pick 2 months to fish all year, September and October would be at the top of the list. The oppressive heat fades, the crowds thin out, the fish feed hard, fattening up before winter. Whether you're chasing a personal best trout or following a school of reds across a glassy flat, fall is a reminder of why this bay remains so special and why it's worth fighting to protect. We will hook you up. Contact Captain Thompson at R&K Coastal Outfitters at gmail.com or go online to rnkcoastaloutfitters.com. Thanks for listening. Time to cast and blast. The Fish and Game Forecast Center. Middle Coast Focus, Rockport. Reported by Captain Jared McCulloch. Mother Nature has been happy to throw plenty of rain our way this year in the Rockport area, and I'm sure she will be throwing more at us for the start of dove season. I don't think she likes that we make dove poppers out of her little birds, but that's just too bad. I'm seeing plenty of goatweed and natural sunflowers all over. I am willing a good dove season to be upon us, but that's after a morning of fishing, of course. Every spot on the bay by September is worn out. Trout, reds, drum are all onto our tricks and methods. Stay strong and don't let them deceive you. They are there. You'll feel them pick up your bait and drop it, so don't fall for it. They can't help themselves. They will come back and pick it up. Give them a long leash to hang them on. I like to start looking at the reefs in the middle of the bays, the areas we don't generally go to because of heavy winds the rest of the year. The old oil wells in the bay can be worth getting in the lineup with. A lot of people stay away from the small feeder wells out there. It may take 2 or 3 of them, but they hold good fish, just not in the numbers as the bigger wells. Never pass on good structure, no matter how big or small it is. That goes for the bridges in this area. The fish are looking for some sunscreen, too. For the late summer waders, my hat is off to you. I generally don't have any wading trips this time of year, maybe 1 or 2, but there's still plenty of fish to catch up skinny. The superflats will generally start gathering redfish, and a lot of times, they don't like the boats. This is perfect for the wader to slip in and have a great day fighting redfish while not sinking in the mud. I keep a healthy stock of colors and sizes this time of year. Or, if we get any shad pushing back in late, I like to have some silvers to imitate them whenever I see them busting near a shoreline. All this is while we wait for the first cold front to show itself in October. Not only are we looking for a little break from the heat, but it's our kickoff to stronger tide movements, and for the fans of chasing bull reds, the green flag in the air, to do so. The jetties and up and down the ship channel are groups of bull reds waiting to be fought. We'll see them moving in and out of the flats with our tasty slot-size reds as well. If you are deep, the heavy bucktail jigs with a shrimp fed onto the hook work well for reds. Shad if you can find them, of course. But don't be afraid of trimming up a piggy in the flats for your reds to munch on. Contact Captain McCulloch at firstlighttexas@gmail.com or call 210-478-6519. Thanks for listening. In the heat of autumn, the Fish and Game Forecast Center, Lower Coast Focus, Baffin Bay, reported by Captain Jared Merritt. What can I say about September and October other than it's hot outside and the fishing is even hotter? I do not necessarily mean it's too hot to fish, but the bite is on and we are in full swing with our cast and blast season. The trout are moving around and are thick in all areas of Baffin Bay, the Laguna Madre, and land cut. Looking for bait and finding just the right amount this time of year can be key in all areas we cover. There are definitely times where too much bait works against you, but I still get the itch to stop and try it. Large schools of bait may look promising, but there can be times when you just cannot coax the fish towards you. We are still using live bait, including croaker and live shrimp. Which one we use depends on availability and what we are trying to accomplish. The Baffin Bay rocks are still holding good fish, as well as the grass lines and potholes. Sandbars, points, and drop-offs can also be productive when following fish in or out. Success of these areas depends on tide and water temperature fluctuations. Wade fishing is producing good solid fish in large numbers, as well as fun times and memories throwing lures. I suggest remembering to throw artificials that match the water color or change in water color. You should also adjust tails and techniques until you find what the fish are aggressively approaching. Although we use live bait more often than lures, we can accommodate any trip our guests want to experience. We always leave from the back west side of Baffin Bay, meaning as soon as you step on the boat, you are in Baffin Bay. That being said, we may occasionally head to the Laguna Madre or land cut to find fish, but we do this to ensure you have the best chance of a fun and successful trip. We invite everyone down to Baffin Bay for an unforgettable trip. Our full cast and blast package, which includes fishing, dove hunting, and waterfront lodging, is tailored to accommodate anglers and outdoor adventurers of all ages and experience levels. Feel free to give us a call at Paradise Guide Services or the Ranch House on Baffin Bay. Contact Captain Merritt at jaredmerritt@gmail.com or visit his website, paradiseguideservices.com. Thanks for listening. Chasing Bigs. The Fish and Game Forecast Center, Lower Coast Focus, Lower Laguna Madre, reported by Captain Brian Barrera. September and October are truly two of my favorite months to fish. Our fishery shows off its versatility this time of year, and you can almost target any species that our fishery has to offer. The kingfish are in at the inlet, big tarpon are hanging out, little tarpon are around, schools of bullreds are plentiful around the jetties and deeper areas of the flats. Our speckled trout and red fishing is great this time of year. Big snook and mangrove snapper are eating topwaters, and the weather is calm enough to get out and enjoy some nearshore wrecks for red snapper, ling, and more. Although most species are plentiful this time of year, you can find me and my clients chasing bigs at the inlet and nearshore wrecks. We are almost primarily after bullreds, kingfish, and tarpon on my charters. For the bullred fish, I like to use live bait such as mullet, pinfish, and crabs. I'll also use artificial lures, like a DOA bait buster or a 2-ounce jigging spoon for dropping down or sight casting into big schools of boiling redfish. When kingfishing, the preferred method by most anglers seems to be trolling at a slow rate of speed, using a wire leader and big Rapala rattle traps and other deep diving lures. Another fun way I like to do is free lining ribbonfish into the current or casting big swim baits that are heavy enough to get down in the water column. Sometimes, when we really want to have fun, we'll throw topwaters at them, but the hookup ratio isn't as good. When tarpon fishing, we hook most of our fish on artificials, but we land most of our fish probably on live bait, mainly because of the circle hooks. When throwing artificials, I use a DOA bait buster or an AM fishing lure in the 5 to 7 inch size range, depending on how deep the fish are. Most times they are in 30 to 40 feet of water, so having something heavy to get down in the current really helps out. When live baiting, I make sure to try to have a variety of different baits just in case, but mainly it ends up being mullet, pinfish, and live skipjack, rigged with a big circle hook and heavy leader. Here are a few LLG hotspots for you: jetties, nearshore wrecks, SPI Causeway, RGV Reef, species, kingfish, bullreds, tarpon, best baits, DOA soft plastics, topwaters, live mullet, live pinfish, big rattle traps. Pro tip, it's easier to feed them than it is to fool them. Don't be afraid to send a live one out there on those hot days. Contact Captain Barrera at captbrianbfishing@gmail.com or visit his website, inshorefishingsouthpadre.com. Thanks for listening. Simple Fall Bass Tips. Aptitude Outdoors by Texas Fish and Game, contributing editor Paul Fusinski. Fall bass fishing is a season of transition, challenge, and reward. As temperatures drop and the ecosystem shifts, bass behavior becomes less predictable, requiring anglers to adapt in real time. It's not a one-size-fits-all approach. Success hinges on reading the water, observing subtle changes, and staying flexible with both your technique and presentation. Early fall often begins with the dreaded turnover. Lakes mix from top to bottom, scattering fish and reducing oxygen levels in various zones. During this time, shallow water becomes a refuge. Creek arms, pockets, and backwaters hold fish tight to structure like wood, docks, or riprap. A Texas-rigged soft plastic is effective for flipping into cover. A chatterbait comes into play when fish begin targeting bait fish. It's a great tool for picking off suspended bass relating to shallow cover. For anglers targeting deeper water, a deep-diving crankbait helps cover ground and trigger reaction strikes when finesse presentations fall short. As the lake stabilizes and water temps fall into the low 60s, bass shift into feeding mode. Shad become the main focus, and moving baits take priority. Jerkbaits shine in clear water, drawing fish from a distance along flats and creek channels. Topwater walking baits also excel, producing explosive strikes along rocky banks, grass edges, and docks. When aquatic vegetation is still healthy, hollowbody frogs and buzz toads can be fished over grass mats to mimic surface prey. In cooler weather, white or baitfish-colored patterns match the hatch and prompt aggressive hits. When water temperatures dip into the 50s, the big fish show up. These bass are feeding hard ahead of winter and stage along creek channel swings and transitions. A slow work jig along these edges can be deadly. Square bill crankbaits also remain effective, especially in off-color water, where their wobble and vibration draw strikes near wood, rock, or docks. Contrary to conventional wisdom, topwater still has a place. Buzzbaits with large blades and lighter frames can be retrieved slowly across the surface, even in water as cold as 48 degrees. These aren't high number days, but the quality of fish makes it worth the effort. In Texas river systems like the Sabine, Colorado, or Trinity, complexity is the name of the game. One stretch might be choked with thick hydrilla, while another is bare rock and hard bottom. Some bass hold tight to submerged wood or bridge pilings. Others suspend in current breaks or stack up along deeper ledges and bends. On a single trip, you might throw a glide bait or lipless crankbait across shallow flats, flip frogs into backwater grass, then shift to swim baits or underspins along steep riverbanks. In swift current, small paddle tails, tailspins, and compact finesse rigs are essential tools for pulling both largemouth and spotted bass from eddies and seams. Fall fishing demands versatility and awareness of the ever-changing waters. It's about recognizing when to slow down and when to cover water, when to stick with a pattern, and when to switch it up. For those who embrace the season's unpredictability, fall offers some of the most exciting and satisfying bass fishing of the year. Additional fall bass tips. As daylight hours shorten, pay attention to the timing of your outings. Bass often feed more aggressively during low light periods. Early morning and late afternoon are prime windows. Look for schooling activity on windblown points or flats where baitfish are pushed shallow. Match the hatch with smaller profile baits when fish are keying in on young of year shad. If the bite slows, downsizing your presentation, like switching from a full-size jig to a finesse jig or Ned rig, can trigger strikes. Don't overlook the power of scent in cooler water. Adding attractant to soft plastics can make a difference. Lastly, keep an eye on birds. Diving gulls or herons along a shoreline can signal active bait and feeding bass nearby. Staying mobile and reading subtle clues is key. Fall rewards anglers who think and fish dynamically. Email Paul Fusinski at contactus@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. This concludes this audio edition of Texas Fish and Game Magazine, September-October 2025. We hope you've enjoyed this issue. Print and digital versions of this publication are available on our website, fishgame.com. This has been a production of Texas Fish and Game Publishing Company, LLC. Copyright 2025, all rights reserved.